I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel. That's at 7 p.m. and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to another Throttle Up radio show and podcast. Good to be here, and thank you all for listening. Now, we are in the midst of this coronavirus pandemic, so we will be continuing our discussion of this situation. I guess, you know, I'm thinking about pretty unprecedented situation that we have encountered quite unexpectedly, kind of like the bolt out of the blue. And we're trying to make sense of it all, trying to figure out what, if anything, we can do. What should we do? How should we think about it? And how should we? Well, I guess, in a sense, what I'm thinking about here is, how can we be helpful? Can we be helpful for, you know, for our personal safety, if you will, and how can we be helpful for our families and our communities and our country? What are the things that we can do to be helpful? And so I guess you could say that we're trying to, at least I'm trying to try to get my arms around this thing, trying to figure out what is it that we need to do? What is it that I should do? How should I think about it? And I guess we're sort of like halfway through this initial period. So, well, what are we going to do for this particular show? So I've got some ideas. I've got some things lined up. And I think what we'll do, it will start with a short audio clip from the Surgeon General. I think that that's probably the best way for us to handle it. And then after the short video and audio clip, it's an audio clip, but it's also available on YouTube as well. And you can, and I try to make these things clear to everybody. And this is, of course, you know, I'm using stuff that all of us can access. This is within the public domain. And I guess what I try to do in the terms of value that I attempt, or the value that I bring to the table here, is I try to curate some of this stuff And I look at it from the perspective of what we're trying to accomplish here on this Throttle Up radio show and podcast, and also, you know, things that we can add to the website, throttleupradio.com, and also things that we can add to the upcoming video channel, which should be. We've had some delays in getting the video channel up and running for various reasons, not least of which is this coronavirus crisis that we are all trying to deal with. And so this has put a lot of things on hold. Some of the stuff we're trying to do, we've put on hold. There was some video recording opportunity in Pensacola, Florida, that we actually had to cancel because of this coronavirus situation. The whole operation there was canceled. There is another conference that I was going to in, I think it was the end of July. That's been canceled. And so there's a number of things that have been put on hold. It looks like my work in Chicago has been delayed until the fall. So, and we're all making adjustments. Okay, so we want to start off by taking a brief look at what is going on with respect to the Surgeon General and how is he thinking about things, and then we'll go from there. We have a number of things I want to cover, that as well as some interesting stuff out of the Wall Street Journal. And finally, we'll do some more, listen to more of what people are saying concerning this coronavirus situation, this pandemic that we are trying to deal with. And we are, many of us, me included, are trying to be helpful and trying to maintain a positive outlook on the situation. Positive outlook on getting through this and trying to do the smart thing, trying to do the right thing as we proceed ahead. So let me get this brief audio clip up and running as we begin our work on this radio show for this week.
Joining us now from Washington is the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Jerome Adams. Dr. Adams, thank you again for joining us. We really appreciate your time. We know how busy that you are, but want to get your thoughts on some things, because at first it was said 15 days was needed to slow the spread. Then the president extended it to the end of April. Many people are wondering, what are the chances that that's going to be enough, doctor?
Well, the original 15 days was designed to slow the spread and for us to have time to reassess. And we learned some good things and some bad things. The bad things that we learned are that there are places across the country, no place has been spared, no state has been spared from the spread of this disease. But the good news is when you look at places like Washington, when you look at places like California that aggressively mitigated and social distanced, they were able to level and flatten their curves. And so we're looking at this next 30 days as an opportunity for the entire country to really understand if we do the right things, then we can flatten our curves in our own different areas and actually get to the other side. You ask, is 30 days going to be enough? Well, it will be for some places. It won't be for others, depending on where they are on their curve. But the most important thing to know is that if you are aggressive about mitigation, you can get through to the other side. And usually in about 3 weeks or so to hit your peak and start to see cases come down.
That is the hope. The debate about masks, I know about a month ago you weighed in at first and you were saying, do not buy, do not wear masks if you're healthy. And now the CDC and others are changing their recommendations. So where do you stand right now on people wearing masks that do not have symptoms?
Well, thank you for the opportunity to clear the air on that, Robin. Initially, the CDC, the World Health Organization, and my office recommended against the general public wearing masks based on the best available science at the time in terms of whether or not it prevented the wearer from catching coronavirus. Now, we've learned about this disease, and we've always said we're going to learn more, we're going to adjust, and we've learned that there is a fair amount of asymptomatic spread. And so we've asked the CDC to take another look at whether or not having more people wear masks will prevent transmission of the disease to other people. But here's the most important thing. Even if you do wear a mask, it can't be at the expense of social mm-hmm. distancing. We don't want people to think, hey, I'm going to wear a face covering so it's appropriate for me to go out around other people. The most important thing right now to do is for people to stay at home. And again, the CDC is looking at whether or not we should be recommending more people wear masks when they go out. The final point I would make to people on masks is if you are going to wear a face covering when you go out, please understand you still don't need an N95 mask. And if you take one of those N95 right. masks, you may be taking it out of the hands of a healthcare worker who desperately needs it to care for patients.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I'm glad that you made that. A final question. You were talking about how stay at home, but you know that's not the case all across the country. There are some states that have not issued that, like in Florida. Do you believe that more governors need to have stricter guidelines in their states about staying at home?
Well, what we want everyone to do is to look at these 30 days to stop the spread guidelines, including social distancing, staying 6 feet away from one another, including limiting large gatherings. We trust the governors and the mayors to understand their people and understand whether or not they feel like they can trust the people in their states to make the right decisions. And you see that many governors have said, look, we don't want to take any chances. We're going to ask people to shelter in place. But the most important thing is, regardless of how you do it in your state, you should encourage and enable as many people as possible to stay at home, including providing them social supports so that they can do the right things. And that's why that bill that was passed last week was so incredibly important. We don't want people to feel like they're going to lose their job or miss out on opportunities to be able to support their families because they're doing the right things.
And they're thinking about that. It's April 1st. A lot of bills are due today. Dr. Adams,
we're
going to
get through this, though, Robin.
We
really will. And the good news, like I said, is Washington, Italy, as you all mentioned earlier, even in New York, we're seeing acceleration slow down. I feel confident that we can get through to the other side if we all cooperate and do our part together.
Okay, now we're going to move to some stuff that is, well, I found it kind of interesting in the Wall Street Journal recently. There's a few short articles on how people are thinking about how people are dealing with this coronavirus, how it is, I guess you could say, how it is stimulating us to reflect on what we're doing, how do we live our lives? How do we perform our business activities and operations? How do we engage the customers? How do we deal with our families and loved ones? How do we deal with our community and stuff like that? And so I guess it's useful for us to take a moment to reflect a little bit on the kinds of things we're doing and the kinds of things we ought to be doing. And how did we set up this society of ours? Now, I'm not talking in any way, shape, or form about any kind of revolutionary vigor or stuff like that, or anarchy, or however you want to deal with it. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm looking at it in terms of, okay, we have a great country. Our great country is very, very agile and adaptive and resilient. It's an amazing country. And how can we tap into that resilience? How can we tap into that adaptability, that agility? And what are the things that we need to do? What are the things that we need to do to unleash this this huge potential that we have in this country to deal with these unexpected mission critical events? And you can say, okay, well, this is different. Each event is unique unto itself and that kind of thing. I guess you could probably figure out if you've listened to this show for a while that I don't actually buy into that at all. I do not believe that the world is populated by unique events. I don't believe that at all. That is not something that I have employed in any way in my work. And I've done some fairly interesting high-level work for many, many years. So I don't buy into that. So if this is another mission-critical event, what are we... How do we prepare ourselves, and how do we Well, how do we respond to this? All right. So the first article here, and these are all good. Now, and again, this is the, I'm passing this out as a way for us to engage our critical thinking apparatus. That's the only reason I'm doing that. I'm not subscribing to what this author or that speaker has to say. I'm not a parrot in that sense of the word. I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to promote the idea. So let's stimulate some critical thinking as we try to engage ourselves in dealing with this particular mission critical event. That's all I'm doing here. It is a way for us to consider how we should go about thinking about such things like this. This is a rather serious top of the list event that has occurred in our culture, in our country, and of course across the world. So the first article is entitled "Workplaces Attuned to the Humanity of Workers," and it's by a gentleman by the name of I apologize for that. It is a lady who goes by the name of Kim Scott. I apologize, Kim, for saying that. Ms. Scott is a workplace consultant and the author of Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. All right, so Workplace Attuned to the Humanity of Workers by Kim Scott. So I will read this and make some observations and impressions along the way, as I always do. I like to engage the audience in bring about not only what I'm thinking about, but what others are thinking about this kind of thing also, as sort of like looking at it from a broader perspective than a singular mental construct. So to begin, those of us lucky enough to be able to work from home during the COVID-19 crisis are getting a crash course in how we can come together to do our jobs while remaining physically distant. The experience is giving us a glimpse of the work life of the future, which may be one of the more positive developments to emerge from today's trauma. On a video conference while sheltering in place, we can no longer pretend that there are sharp boundaries between home and work. Kids, pets, impossibly messy or neat rooms, and other clues emerge in the margins of our screens. Managers are now seeing their employees with a fullness they've never experienced before. Yeah, I suppose so. Employees are seeing their bosses' living rooms. These new visibilities will change the way that we manage and are managed. A check-in on how people are doing at the beginning of a staff meeting reveals a lot. Some people are struggling to educate and entertain their children. Others are caring for aging parents in distant cities. Others are feeling isolated, stuck at home alone. It's hard not to care more about people when you know these things. That compassion can help us to go get through this crisis and should last beyond it. And it goes on to say, she goes on to say that, but love is not all we need. We also need truth. As the economy falters, teams that are honest with each other about what they can and can't do, what the priorities and limits must be, are most likely to endure the crisis and prevail. Successful management will focus more on compassion and candor, less on command and control. By the time we emerge from our homes, we also will have learned what technologies are best for different purposes. And I will say parenthetically that's actually a pretty good point. It's something that I've been working on as well in my work in terms of how to engage an audience, how to promote an idea. And I'm working with some folks in Chicago on that very thing in terms of looking at what is available today and how we can leverage that to I'm searching a little bit for words here, but bear with me. So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to look at these emerging technologies, how we can leverage them to engage an audience and promote ideas from a distance, as well as within the same boundary lines, as well as within the same conference room, within the same building, within the same workshop arena, certainly. But beyond that, how we can do meaningful work that is outside those boundary lines, that is at a distance where people are not necessarily clustered together physically in one space, but they are intellectually brought together into one virtual space. And so how do we do that? And what are the things that we need to do? How should we think about it in those kinds of terms? And that's something that I am working on as we speak. I don't have all the answers, but I am definitely working in that direction, I guess you could say, and in that aspect. Let me continue with this article. By the time we emerge from our homes, we also will have learned which technologies are best for different purposes. Many tasks can be done most efficiently using asynchronous communication tools. If, it goes on to say, if you want your team to learn something from an informational video, email it around. But if fostering social connection is your primary goal, use synchronous communication. Stream that video to the team, ask everyone to watch it together, and then chat about it. What we are learning about remote work will open up new opportunities for work-life balance. Most parents are discovering that their work productivity has dropped, but they're getting a dramatic boost in intimacy. When the virus is vanquished, many will want to keep working remotely, enjoying the better use to which they're putting time once spent on commuting. Those who continue to commute will face less traffic and more often get a seat on the train or bus. Everyone will remember how their boss responded during this time. Did they check in frequently? Did they focus on you at a human level? Did they communicate directly and honestly and to give people time to voice their concerns? Did they share information or try to hide it? Ultimately, it may be our ability to upend hierarchical responsibility that gets us through this crisis. It's not only leaders who need to step up with compassion and candor. If the boss is letting stress get the best of them, take a moment to see them as a human being stressed like you. Check in, show that you care, and then push yourself to take a risk. Explain why their behavior is counterproductive. She finishes this piece by saying, we all need to take responsibility as leaders. If we conduct every interaction during this crisis with all the compassion, and honesty we can muster, our work lives can emerge from it changed for the better. Okay, so that completes the article by Kim Scott in the Wall Street Journal, and I will give you the dates of that so that you can also view this article and put it in your stack of stuff that you would like to get to. We all have our stack of stuff. That's Saturday and Sunday, March 28th and 29th of 2020 on page C5. Okay, so, you know, that's a pretty good idea. We talked a little bit about that. And in conclusion, I will say that I really kind of like that idea in terms of looking at it from the perspective of, okay, we often are using the old industrial model where people come together in a common workplace because that's where the factory is. But that's kind of going by the wayside, because in many cases the factory is diversified. We have, for example, 3D printing, which removes the design and manufacturing processes, they do not have to be co-located. And the list goes on and on. And so if we are questioning the old industrial model of how humans come together to perform meaningful, productive work, then how can that, or how should that, or what are the ways by which we can make that work without going back to the old industrial model? I think, you know, in my view of the world, I guess you could say, in my view of reality, we are at the very, very tail end of the old industrial model. And maybe this is an opportunity for us to essentially get rid of it. Do we need to go to the office 5 days a week? Is that absolutely necessary? So let me give you some ideas here. These are just my ideas, and you can come up with your own. But let's say that, yes, we do have a gathering place for the people that are productively employed within our group or within our team. And often what's happening, more and more businesses are looking at quasi-independent agile teams to perform whatever meaningful activity needs to be performed. So these independent agile teams, how do they work? Where do they need to be in order to work, in order to do their work? How do they stay in touch with one another? How do they collaborate? So this team requires, I guess you could say that the team, whatever this team happens to be, it requires us to collaborate. And how do we do that? Do we do that on a kind of a free-for-all basis, or do we do that in more of an organized way? And I'll give you an example of this team, if you will, or this independent agile team that I was involved with. All right, so going back and creating this idea, I was in charge of a independent agile team. I guess you could say that. We didn't actually think of ourselves as that, but we were brought together to to solve a particular problem within the aviation industry. And this problem was unusual. It happened to be a high-level problem, and it happened to deal with things at the federal level as well as the industrial level, as well as the organizational level. So it was not only industry-wide, but it was also at the federal level in terms of its impact. Okay, so the team consisted of, probably 15 to 20 people. All right, so let's say it consisted of 20 people, and it kind of varied a little bit, but that's a good round number. And so, and we were located in a major facility, in a suite of offices in Denver, Colorado, is where we were located. All right, and so members of the team all lived in the greater Denver area, and our job was fairly well defined. It was a meaningful, purposeful activity. We had to produce something that was required by not only the company, but the industry, as well as it had to be presented to, and it had to be understood and officially approved by the federal government. And so that was what we had to do. Now, did we all have to come to work 5 days a week from 8 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock in the afternoon? Was that absolutely necessary? And the answer is no, it wasn't. If we could organize ourselves better, instead of using the laissez-faire approach or the ad hoc approach, if we could organize ourselves better, I was always under the impression that we could do equally as good a job, if not even better, by setting up periods of time where we could collaborate with one another, as well as collaborate with other outside resources that we needed to acquire, and do as good a job and perhaps even better than what we were doing utilizing the old industrial model. And so I believe that that's probably something that could help us. And it could be a major side benefit of getting through this crisis, where our travel is restricted and our ability to come together is constrained in larger groups working remotely more and more. I think we can utilize the modern technology, leverage that, and help us help us in a way, and it might be even better than what we have now. Here's something, and this is something that I'm actually working on as we speak. This is kind of interesting. And this, let me pull this this sentence out from this article that I was just reading from. It says that, but if fostering social connection is your primary goal, use synchronous communication. Stream that video to the team. Ask everyone to watch it together and then chat about it. Okay, so here they're capitalizing on our ability to create and to distribute video content almost on a real-time basis. It very, very quickly, let's say. And that's something that I'm working on as well. And that I think that's going to have a lot of benefit for us, because, first of all, video is easier for us to, observe, if you will, or easier for us to pass along information and insight and comprehension. And here we have the ability, and I think video is probably one of the best ways for us to engage in collaborative reasoning. So we have this this mechanism by which we can create video content and distribute it widely in a very, very simple, easy fashion. And by doing so, we can improve our ability to collaborate in many, many different ways. And so that's something that I think is a great, well, you know, it could be a great benefit of what we're trying to, or a great benefit of our inability now to, for many of us, to go to the office on a, 5 days a week. And so we have to work more remotely. Maybe we can come up with ideas like this that would help us to be more productive, spend a lot less time commuting back and forth every day to our place of work. Okay, so we will be right back with the second article I want to read, which I think is interesting as well. Okay, so this is the article, the second article, the Wall Street Journal, of course, this area of Wall Street Journal is called After the Pandemic. Title is The Biotech Century Ahead by Walter Isaacson. He starts by saying the coronavirus plague will hasten our transition to the third great innovation revolution of modern times. These revolutions arose from the discovery, beginning just over a century ago, of the three fundamental kernels of our existence: the atom, the bit, and the gene. The first half of the 20th century, beginning with Albert Einstein's 1905 paper on relativity and quantum theory, featured a revolution driven by physics. Advances in basic science became, as always, the seed corn from which sprang useful inventions. In the five decades following Einstein's miracle year, his theories and those of his fellow physicists led to atomic bombs and nuclear power, semiconductors and transistors, spaceships and GPS, lasers and radar. He goes on to say that the second half of the 20th century was an information technology era based on the idea that all information could be encoded by binary digits known as bits, and all logical processes could be performed by circuits with on-off switches. In the 1950s, this led to the development of the microchip, the computer, and the internet. When these three inventions were combined, it led to the digital revolution. Now we have entered a third and even more momentous scientific era, a life science revolution driven by biotech. It rests on the discovery of the gene and the molecules, that's DNA and RNA, that contain and implement its information. By the beginning of this century, we had the power to sequence and map our genes and those of every organism. He goes on to say that one particularly consequential invention in this new revolution is, and I don't know what this is, but it's an acronym, it's CRISPR, CRISPR, a tool that will allow us to edit genes. Like most inventions, it was born out of curiosity-driven basic science, in this case involving the longest-running and most vicious war on the planet. For 3 billion years, bacteria have struggled to fight off attacks by viruses, which are snippets of genetic material that reproduce by taking over the cells of living organisms. CRISPR, that's the acronym of this thing, CRISPR systems are a wondrous method that bacteria came up with to remember, recognize, and destroy the genetic material of enemy viruses. Which leads us, he says, to our own fight against the new coronavirus. CRISPR tools are already being developed that will detect the virus and eventually ward it off. But in a larger way, the coronavirus will focus the attention of a new generation of scientists and innovators. Just as the digital revolution drove innovation in the last half of the 20th century, the biotech revolution will drive the first half of the 21st century. Children who study digital coding will be surpassed by those who study the code of life. The revolution will have at least three major components. First is an effort to fight viruses at the molecular level using RNA-guided genetic targeting devices, just like bacteria do. Our recurring viral plagues, which includes MERS, SARS, Ebola, HIV, AIDS, and, of course, each new strain of the flu, show how pitifully poor we have been at this. Second is discovering the underlying mechanisms of cancer and finding ways to personalize treatments for it. And a third is editing our own genes. Gene editing technology could make us immune to viruses and cancer. It can correct mutations that cause a wide array of disabilities, from sickle cell anemia to congenital blindness, and it could let us genetically enhance our bodies and minds and those of our children. That will be the hard part. We'll need not only scientists and innovators, but also philosophers, humanists, and well-informed citizens to figure out whether that's a wise use of this astounding technology. And that is the end of the article. All right. And so now that is something for us to, you know, consider. And this is probably a good time for us to actively consider this emerging capability. One of the things that I've noticed in my more or less unstructured efforts to gain an insight into the coronavirus is that I have been watching some informational videos that talk about viruses in general and talk about how viruses invade the body, and they talk about things related to viruses and how zinc and malaria medicine, oxychloroquine, I think, I'm sorry, I may be butchering that that term chloroquine, I think, is the malaria medicine, and how that works. And that's actually kind of a fascinating thing. And I guess I should spend some time on that perhaps next week, in terms of how that works and why that might be something that is beneficial for all of us, for not only the coronavirus, but for other things as well. And the thing that I was thinking about is, was it yesterday, I believe it was, that if in fact this has some kind of a beneficial effect, what is this our first efforts to come up with a way for us to pharmaceutically deal with viruses? Now, we have pharmaceutical methods in place to deal with bacteria, but we don't have any pharmaceutical methods to deal with viruses, or at least that's what I understand it to be, except maybe now we do. And a combination of these zinc and this other medication might very well be the thing that prevents the growth of viruses within the cell domain. Okay, anyway, so now we're going to have another short audio clip, and then that should conclude our show for the week. Hang on.
Our country is in the midst of a great national trial, unlike any we have ever faced before. You all see it. You see it probably better than most. We're at war with a deadly virus. Success in this fight will require the full, absolute measure of our collective strength, love, and devotion. Very important. Each of us has the power, through our own choices and actions, to save American lives and rescue the most vulnerable among us. That's why we really have to do what we all know is right. Every citizen is being called upon to make sacrifices. Every business is being asked to fulfill its patriotic duty. Every community is making fundamental changes to how we live, work, and interact each and every day. And I wouldn't be surprised to see this going on long into the future when this virus is gone and defeated. Some of the things we're doing now will be very good practice for the future, including for not getting the flu, which is very devastating also. So some of what we're learning now will live on into the future. I really believe that shaking hands or not shaking hands, washing hands all the time, staying a little apart. 15 days ago, we published our nationwide guidelines to slow the spread of the virus. On Sunday, I announced that this campaign will be extended until April 30th. In a few moments, Dr. Birx will explain the data that formed the basis for our decision to extend the guidelines, and Dr. Fauci will explain why it's absolutely critical for the American people to follow the guidelines for the next 30 days. It's a matter of life and death, frankly. It's a matter of life and death. I know our citizens will rise to the occasion, and they already have sacrificed a lot. We had the greatest economy in the history of our country. We had the greatest economy in the world. We had the best unemployment numbers and employment numbers that we've ever had by far. And in one instant, we said we have no choice but to close it up. Just as Americans have always done, they will do a job like few have seen before, and they're proud to do it. I see that. There's a great pride going on right now. Before we hear from our experts, we have a few other announcements today. The Treasury Department and Small Business Administration announced further details on the Paycheck Protection Program, which was made possible by the $2 trillion relief bill I signed into law last week. Nearly $350 billion in loans will soon be available through lending partners to help small businesses meet payroll and other expenses for up to 2 months. These loans will be forgiven as long as businesses keep paying their workers. This includes sole proprietors and independent contractors. Applications will be accepted starting this Friday, April 3rd. So on Friday, April 3rd, that's when it begins. Earlier today, I spoke with leading internet and phone providers who are doing a tremendous job of keeping our internet and lines of communication flowing under very strongly increased strain. The business is more than anybody has seen before because everyone's inside. They're all making calls. Among the leaders I spoke to were Hans Vestberg of Verizon Communications, Randall Stevenson of AT&T, Mike Sievert of T-Mobile, Thomas Rutledge of Charter Communications, Brian Roberts of Comcast, John Malone of Liberty Media, Dexter Goy of Altice, Michael Combs of Sprint, and Araya Borkoff of Liontree. Also, Pat Esser of Cox Communications and Jeffrey Story of CenturyLink. They're doing an incredible job. If you look at other continents, if you look at Europe, they went a different route than we did, and a much different route. We were talking about that just a little while ago. And they're having tremendous problems. Other countries are having problems. Other continents are having problems. But with business at a level that nobody's seen it before on the internet, it's holding up incredibly well. And they expect that to continue no matter what happened and no matter how much more it gains, which if it can gain more than it already is, I don't know, because they're setting records. Let me also update you on the distribution of urgently needed resources and supplies. And we have a lot of numbers. I'm going to let Mike Pence speak to that in a little while. But we're giving massive amounts of medical equipment and supplies to the 50 states. We also are holding back quite a bit. We have almost 10,000 ventilators that we have ready to go. We have to hold them back because the surge is coming, and it's coming pretty strong. And we want to be able to immediately move it into place without going and taking it. So we're ready to go. And we've also distributed. I just spoke with the governor of Michigan, had a great conversation. And we sent a large number of ventilators to Michigan. We're sending them to Louisiana. We sent additional ventilators to New York, additional ventilators to New Jersey. And I will say, in New York, FEMA is supplying 250 ambulances and 500 EMTs to help respond to the increasing caseload. That's a lot of ambulances. In California, the Army Corps of Engineers is developing 8 facilities to expand hospital capacity up to 50,000 beds.
Okay, so I think that's probably pretty good news. We're getting at the end of the show, and so I had to break that off a little earlier than I wanted to. But anyway, yes, if we put these measures in place, I kind of agree. I have hopes that in about 2 weeks, we're going to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And I will see you all next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here, and I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service, and I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.